This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 64. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. If you stick around till the end of the episode, we're going to be discussing hiring and managing remote developers in depth. What's going on this week, Mike?
Last week, I remember you would you'd mentioned that Google AdWords issue where if you go in and you browse and you search for different things, there was a little newsletter pop-up for somebody to sign up for directly through the Google AdWords. And I did some research on that, and unfortunately it's in beta, but it's basically just an AdWords extension that they've added on. They've added on a couple of different AdWords extensions over the years, and this is just one that is currently in beta, so I couldn't get much info on it. And you know, there's a little bit of speculation here and there, but it seems to be rather new. It's only been out there for maybe a month or so.
Yeah, I've never actually seen it in the wild. You're the one that stumbled upon it when we were having kind of an offline conversation. We didn't talk about it all on the podcast last week. Explain to the listeners what it is.
So when you go to Google and you do a search for something, what Google does is, in addition to showing the paid search results right underneath, or actually is embedded in line with some of those search results that are paid for, you'll have just a text field that says subscribe. And there's a button off to the side. I don't know whether you can customize the subscribe button or not. And it will fill in your email address if you're already logged into Google services. And I assume that it goes through and just, you know, signs you up for whatever mailing list that they have. Now, if I remember correctly, it also directly sends your email address to them. I don't know if there's any sort of double opt-in or anything like that, but it looked interesting. The one thing I question is whether or not people are going to actively hand out their email addresses through something on that, unless you explicitly say in the text of the ad that you're giving something away for free and they can only get it if they sign up.
Yeah, it's got to be a big you're basically selling to them in, like, what do you have, 50 characters or something? I mean, mm-hmm. It's like 10 words tops, you know? So you really have to convince someone to give you their email quickly. It's not like you have even a sidebar with a little photo or anything like that. It's just very, very tight. So we'll see how it goes. I think it's an interesting experiment, obviously, but I'd be curious to try it out at some point. And it's AdWords only. I mean, it's kind of a bummer they don't allow it in the search results, but I'm sure they're not going to allow people to do that. They want you to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hey, my update, the new Hittail design is up. It's live.
Really?
Yeah. I launched it yesterday. So everyone rush out to hittail.com and check it out. It's a lot of work. Trying to think, I didn't have nearly as many issues as I thought I would once I rolled it live, because I did it kind of a commando launch. You know, I did not have the massive QA team doing all kinds of monitoring and all that stuff. I just kind of, I knew it worked pretty well, and I tested the major functions. I put it up yesterday. I emailed everybody, all the active users, and said, come check it out. And
cool.
I think the biggest issue has been caching, of course. Like, certain people's browsers are still caching old images, and they have same names, and so things look weird for a handful.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Once we clear cache and clear cookies and all that, or open in a different browser, everything's been working. So
cool.
Yeah, it's been good. Have gotten a lot of emails about it, which is both good and bad, because it's good because it's nice people are interested, but it's bad because I don't have time to answer them all, so... But I'm excited. Yeah, moved to a whole new pricing model. Moved away from the PayPal payments, where people have to go off-site. So now it's credit card processing through Stripe. I'm just excited to see how it impacts conversion rates. Because now I ask for a credit card up front instead of letting them do a full trial and then like trying to beg them to sign up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just totally different conversion rates when you do that, right?
Right.
If you get the credit card up front, you're going to convert a lot more people. So. It's exciting. It's a new day. And if anyone's curious and wants to see the old design, they can go to old.hittail.com. I left it up just for posterity for now. I'm going to want to take some screenshots for presentations, because it's definitely going to be a case study. I'm hoping that I can dramatically improve conversion rates and such, and use it in my talks and blog posts and such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a pretty dramatic difference between old.hittail.com and just hittail.com.
Yeah.
Cool. I've been doing something similar. I've been kind of working on my marketing sites for Audit Shark and for my forum software, which I have profusely neglected for far too long. So basically trying to do those more or less in parallel. I've looked into a couple of different CSS frameworks, and I've been experimenting with the Twitter Bootstrap framework. Have you taken a look at that or no?
No, I've barely even heard of it.
So if you just search for Twitter Bootstrap, what you'll find is a link to, you'll probably end up on GitHub or something like that. But basically you can download all of the CSS templates for the framework that Twitter is built on. And it everything looks very nice. It's got very high quality layout CSS that you can throw in there.
I've seen it before. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting to work with. I think the one thing that I find a little bit, not disconcerting, but a little bit challenging is the fact that if you want to use like a different color scheme for the background or for that top level navigation bar or for a footer or something like that, you have to kind of work them in yourself. So you can't really rely on the CSS that's coming down from, you know, the CDNs that they provide. I mean, you can to some degree. I mean, you have to supply your own custom CSS file, but I question is whether or not using their service is a good idea for that. I mean, you don't exactly have quality control over that.
So are you building something from scratch then by hand instead of going with like WordPress or having a designer build something?
I am. Part of the reason for that is over the past probably, I'd say 2 weeks or so, I've been doing a lot of debugging on my server to try and figure out exactly why things seem so slow. And it's all built on WordPress, so, you know, obviously there's only so many places that there could be issues. And what I've done is I've gone through my entire WordPress installation. I have done massive optimizations. I've streamlined everything. I've turned off as many possible plugins as I can. And I've gotten the page load speeds down to less than a second. Before, they were going upwards of, I don't know, 5-6 seconds, depending on what page you were going to.
Which website is this?
For both singlefounder.com, I did all these optimizations there because I knew that probably had more traffic than AuditShark. And then on AuditShark.com, I did some optimizations there as well. But I think I had mentioned it before, like the Contact 7 plugin, for example, is loaded on every single page, regardless of whether you use it on that page or not. So like all the CSS files and the JavaScript files and everything, they get, you know, for all those plugins, they tend to get loaded regardless of whether you use those plugins on the page or not. So what happens is that slows down your site as a whole. So I started out with singlefounder.com and tried working on my blog because I knew that I would see a lot more speed increases there just because there's so much more content. And I was able to get initially the load times were in the neighborhood of 5 to 6 seconds. When I was done, they were down to about maybe 3/4 of a second, but that was if it was cache. I signed up for a pingdom.com account and started tracking to see how fast my different servers were, because I have a Windows server out there, and I also have a Linux server that, you know, I run most of my stuff on, but there's still some things I have to run Windows applications on. And what I found was that on singlefounder.com, there were images that were not loading immediately. They were, you know, 10, 15K images, but they were taking anywhere from 3 to 4 seconds to load. And when the page itself, the entire thing loads in 5 seconds, and you've got one or two images that are, you know, they're being loaded in parallel, but they're still taking 3 to 4 seconds for just those couple of images, you know, there's something obviously wrong. So I tried figuring out, okay, well, is it the fact that it's WordPress? Is it just these images? And I what I did was I pointed Pingdom directly to those images, not even loading the page, just loading those images. And I found that there's something between some of the Pingdom servers and my web server that are just causing some sort of issue. And I haven't quite been able to track it down yet. I mean, for all I know, it could be the server itself.
Yeah, isn't it just the server serving it slow? I mean, it'd have to be, right? How can there be anything between the Pingdom and your static image coming off a web server?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I can think of ways. I mean, if that traffic is getting misrouted, or if it's getting, you know, rerouted based on some, you know, security firewall that it runs into and says, oh, well, I have to analyze this packet. Or maybe if the image itself, when it gets requested, the server says, oh, I've got this image. It's, you know, it's meets these specific requirements. I have to, you know, zip it before I send it down. You know, stupid things like that. And right, I have yet to be able to figure out exactly what the problem is, because sometimes it loads very, very quickly. I mean, it'll load that image in, maybe 100, 150 milliseconds. And then there's times where it'll take 3 seconds.
The big question in my mind is, why are you doing this? Like, why are you spending the time to speed all this stuff up? I mean, I guess with singlefounder.com, if it's 5 to 6 seconds, it's your blog and everything, I can understand spending some time on it. But I would just change web hosts at this point, man. Because if you've even invested 3-4 hours into it, it's like it's not paying itself back. You know what I'm saying? But it's like Audit Shark isn't even live yet. You know what I'm saying? Like, why optimize now instead of just getting something up there?
It was more a matter of trying to figure out where the problem is. I mean, because if it's a WordPress problem, it's not going to help to move to a different site. You know, if it's a DNS server issue, which I've found that my DNS servers respond, depending on which one it is, I have one that responds at about 80 milliseconds, another one at around 100, which is not a big deal in the grand scheme of things. But what I did find through the process of digging was that within WordPress, there were a lot of plugins that were active, which, you know, I thought that I wanted these plugins. You know, for example, one was Jetpack, which gives me these analytics on my site that tells me, you know, what people are searching for and gives me more of a real-time status of what people are looking at on my site and how many people are actually on it, things like that. But what I found was that it was the cost benefit analysis, you know, it just showed it just wasn't worth it to have those things. I mean, they were sucking up a lot of time to load these pages. And I really think that people were coming to my site and just saying, you know, this takes too long to load. I'm out of here. And because that translates to pretty much every single site that I had, I'm like, well, you know, I need to at least spend some time here to figure out what's going on. And I really wanted to revamp the marketing a little bit anyway. So it just seemed like an appropriate time to start looking at that stuff and do a little bit of digging and see whether or not it was a problem with WordPress or something else.
Well, if all your sites are slow, I would bet that it's your host.
It's not.
And if it's only some of them, then it's probably plugins in WordPress.
But what bothers me is that, like, as I said, pointing to a specific image, sometimes that image will load in 100 milliseconds, and sometimes it takes 3 seconds.
Yeah.
And I think that's the server.
I got an email last week from a WordPress architect and developer after he heard the last, it was 2 episodes ago when you and I kind of made a call. He emailed me. I think his rate's pretty decent. I would recommend maybe hiring him. Sounds like there's just a better option than trying to troubleshoot this stuff yourself. When you're talking about doing like YSLO stuff and spending hours and hours on it, I just feel like your time could be better spent doing other stuff, you know?
No, I agree. I talked to somebody else, by the way. I don't know whether it may have been the same person. Just kind of chatted back and forth via email about, you know, what sort of things he's done for other sites and, you know, what sort of things he's used to help speed things up. And, you know, we just going back and forth, I was like, I tried this. And he's like, you know, I don't see anything obvious that you've done that isn't really doing it. I mean, really, it kind of comes down to, at this point, the servers. I mean, there's nothing else to try. So I think it's a matter of just saying, okay, well, you know, either have my host move my VPS to a different server or ditch them entirely and go someplace else.
Right. I per your kind of suggestion, I went back and I listened to a bunch of the early podcasts, and you're right. They're not nearly as bad as I had remembered. They're actually pretty darn good. Yeah. It was entertaining. And I actually like how I felt like the podcasts get better as we go on because we share more about what we're doing and we don't just talk about 5 ways to do this or X rules to do that. Like, we actually share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. you know, but it really, that's when it gets more interesting for me listening to it. So, but there were three loose ends that, or three kind of funny things listening back that came up that I'd totally forgotten about. One, in episode 8, which way, way long ago. Yeah. You said, we're starting work on a SaaS app and I expect it to launch in September or October. And that was 2010. Isn't that crazy? And that's what became Audit Shark.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the very first mention of it. You didn't talk about the name at all. Obviously, I mean, I think it was...
I didn't have a name at the time.
Right. Episode 8, we would have recorded it in early 2010. So you were expecting it to take like 9 months of development. So just a little point for the astute listener. Now, the other thing I noticed was in
Let's just rename this episode to Embarrass Mike with Failures. Yeah, exactly. Failed predictions.
Yeah. The other one was in September of 2010, in episode 23, I predicted Borders going out of business. Dun, dun, dun. Not like anyone else wouldn't have done the same, but I basically was like, I think Barnes & Noble is going to stick around and Borders going to go out of business. And I thought that was funny now that they filed whatever, chapter 13. Mm. And then the last thing was in episode 2, you talked about relaunching your forum software. And that was actually something you mentioned several times in the first maybe 5-6 episodes, and then it just disappeared. And so it's funny you brought it up today, because I was going to ask you about it. Like, what's the update on that? You know, did it ever happen? Did you decide not to do it? What's the story?
I held back, to be honest, and I don't have a good reason for it. It was, I'll be honest, it was fear of putting it out there, because I'm like, man, I don't really like how this is put together. The reality is I probably should have just done it and kind of cleaned up afterwards, but being kind of the quote-unquote perfectionist, I just said, no, I don't want to put this out there yet. And I never really made it a priority. So right. I've kind of gone back and said, you know, I've had this sitting here on the shelf for probably far too long. And it's really not that far from being able to be relaunched. So I don't know how much work it is. I haven't really sat down to figure that out. But I've been basically going through the marketing for it and saying, you know, I really got to just put this out there and be done with it. We'll see how that goes. I'm kind of doing that in parallel with the Audit Shark marketing and a couple of other things. So
right. But. And then the last thing is I realized I used to give updates about my book sales. I haven't done that in a long time. I'm over 6,500 copies sold.
Good for you.
Yeah, thanks. It's for people who haven't heard about it, it's called Start Small, Stay Small, A Developer's Guide to Launching a Startup. It's available at startupbook.net, or you can get it on Amazon. But it's basically my take on getting something out the door without venture capital. And the reason I had this big jump in probably in the last 4 or 5 months, and I could not figure out why this was happening. I kept getting these emails from Amazon at the end of the month, and normally the Kindle payment would come through and, you know, it'd be X amount. And suddenly it was like 5 times that. And I was like, why am I selling a tremendous amount of Kindle versions of this thing? And just suddenly, you know, I hadn't done any marketing, anything like that specific to this. Well, as it turns out, if you go to Amazon, you search for Lean Startup. Yeah, you go to Eric Ries's Lean Startup book in Kindle version. The customers who bought this also has Start Small, Stay Small. It's like the 4th or 5th one over. And so his is like a New York Times bestseller. And so that's my best guess, is that there's so much traffic to that page that it's like selling hundreds of copies per month of my book. So you can just imagine how many his are selling.
Mm-hmm.
Just having some type of a tie-in. It's increasing your luck surface area, I think so.
Luck surface area, that's nice. Yeah.
That's from Jason Roberts from Texing. So today we have a listener question that is 7 points. And so we're basically architecting the whole episode after it. And we're going to be talking about hiring and managing remote workers. And the email, which I'm not going to read all at once because it is so long, we're kind of going to take it point by point, is from Glenn Germain, and he's at mypractice.net.au. And he says, I'm the founder of a startup that has been going for 6 years. I'm the sole developer and now have one person working full-time and 2 part-time that handle sales and support. We deal with non-techie people in the health industry, generally individuals and small practices. Sales are fairly high touch, to coin a term you guys use. I'm at the point where I really need help on the dev side of things, as we have several integration points we need to address. We need to do this to remain relevant and grow in our market. I'm keen to use Odesk, Elance, or a similar service, as I can't afford to employ a full-time dev at present. My issue is that I feel there are several roadblocks and concerns. Point one, I feel as if the app and the requirements are complex enough that it would take me considerable time to bring someone up to speed. I believe this would require a great deal of hand-holding. Point two, point one is not a showstopper. I expect a ramping up period. The fear is that I will spend the time only to find the individual or company turns out to be duds. In other words, unable or incapable of doing the job to a satisfactory level, and I would have to start again. And number three, so my concern here is that I could waste a great deal of time and money. Have you guys got any history or stories you could share or lessons learned you could discuss?
In my experience, the things that I've run into, those exact same fears have essentially stopped me in several cases from pursuing that direction. You know, other times I've actually gone through and said, I know that I've got to do it. The problem is that if you don't make the time, it's never going to happen. And so you're never going to alleviate that pain. You basically have to just bite the bullet and do it. There's really not much you can do about whether or not somebody's going to turn out to be a dud or not. I mean, you can try and do your best effort up front to make sure that you're going to work through and eliminate people who aren't going to just walk away when things get tough, or are going to dedicate the time to actually learn the things that they need to do to get the job done. But there's only so much you can do. And it's just like hiring somebody full time. I mean, you're going to have to put in some time and effort, and it may not pan out. You may end up hiring somebody full time. You think you've gone through all this great process of eliminating all the bad candidates and you get down to one or two people and you hire somebody. And then 3 months later, they say, no, this really isn't what I signed up for. I'm out of here. This is something that you could potentially run into no matter what. But if you want to eliminate the pain that you're currently having where you just don't have enough development cycles to get things done, you're going to have to do it. And whether you do it now or you do it 2, 3, 4 months down the road, it's something you're going to have to eventually get done.
Yeah, to give an example from some recent experience of mine, I've been doing quite a bit of hiring. I hired a DBA, I hired three part-time developers just to help with some smaller tasks. I've hired a couple VAs in the past couple weeks. And in all those cases, I went through the same process. And the process was this. I happen to use Odesk. I like it because it tracks what people are doing. And when I have a brand new contractor, I just like to kind of know what they're up to and know how many hours they're billing and know that there's a limit on it. And Elance doesn't offer me as much flexibility with that. It doesn't offer as much monitoring. Now, when someone works for me for a long time, I don't care about that stuff. But upfront, Odesk has worked. So I'll use them in the examples. Basically, I have posted a job. I get a bunch of applicants, and it's pretty obvious there's typically about 20%, 25% that totally are not going to fit. And typically there's another 30, 40% that may be out of budget. And so I take the other guys and gals, and I start running through them and really creating a short list. And then I will email my top three, maybe top five. And what I do is I ask them specific questions that I specifically did not include in the job description, because I want to see how well they reply. I want to see how well their written English is. I want to see how well they understand my questions. You know, it's typically things about like their working arrangement, where they work, do they work daytime job and then are going to do this at nights and weekends and that kind of stuff. So it's enough. There's enough complexity there that I can learn pretty quickly if their cover letter of their profile was written by someone else or edited by someone else, and I can get an idea of how good their English is. And this is true for native English speakers as well, right? I mean, I want someone who can communicate well. So I go from there. Typically, I can narrow down to an even smaller list. Then I give them a trial project that includes, you know, both VAs and developers. I don't see any other way that you're going to do that here. I know later Glenn talks about only having large projects to give, but there has to be something that you can pull out that's like a 2 to 4 hour project. Make one up if you need to. But if you have one, give it to all three of them at once, hire them all. The pay rates are not so high that you can't afford to do that. And then see who delivers. And that's how I've been doing it. And I've been having pretty good luck. The one exception, and it does support what Glenn's fear is, but this is out of 5 hires in the past 3 months. The one exception is I found a really good VA and everything checked out. And I talked to her on Skype and everything worked. And then I hired her, and on day one, day two or day three, she just disappeared. And that was a bummer. But I had my shortlist, and I just went back to the other two people, and I found out if they were available, and I hired another one right away. So my big loss really was, it was a few hours of training her, but I didn't train her in person. I created screencasts, and I wrote docs. And so when the new person came through, I was able to just forward them the same links, and I didn't have to say all the same stuff again. So I think that would be a big piece of my advice, is that if you are going to hire someone, you start small, and then you do create repeatable stuff to train them, at least for, you know, the kind of the general stuff. There's going to be general stuff about your app you're going to want to explain. Do not do that in person. Create a screencast or a doc that describes it so you can reuse that if someone decides to bail. So the next question from Glenn, he says, I'm also unclear on the best methods for communicating my requirements. I've heard Rob mention doing screencasts for his VAs in previous shows, and that sounds like a great idea. The idea of sitting down to spec out one of these integration points is horrifying, as some of them require using APIs that are less than ideal. I feel if I'm going to design and spec the whole thing up front, then I might as well write it as well. I feel I need someone who I can get started and then iterate with them as we flesh out the intricacies. So my question is, how would you handle this?
I would definitely go about building those screencasts and working through and scoping that stuff out, because there's a couple of different things that doing that will do. And the first one is that if your APIs right now are kind of hellish to work through because they're just very complicated, writing the documentation for them are going to make handing those APIs over to your customers a little bit less painful. I mean, people are going to actually be able to work with them. In addition, as you grow your team, those that documentation and those specs are going to help others in the future. So don't think of this as you're writing this documentation or you're doing these screencasts for just one person. Think of it as these are training materials that you can hand off to somebody and say, hey, I would like you to look at these and read these and get familiar with them so that you know how to do your job or do the things that we need you to do.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. There's such a big part of the reuse. You're not going to be able to reuse an exact spec of an exact project. Well, I guess you would be. If you give it to one person and he or she bailed, then you would be able to reuse it with the next person. But there are going to be these assets you create, like the general walkthrough of what your app is, what it does, basics of how it works, basics of the technology. Like, to me, that is perfect for a screencast, because if you didn't create a screencast, you'd probably jump on Skype with someone, right? That's typically how I'd want to walk them through in general. And so a screencast is by far a better way to do it. And it may run 20, 30 minutes, but that's okay, because then you have it for the long term. You can reuse it. He said he heard me doing screencasts for VAs. I do. With VA tasks in particular, everything's a screencast. Unless it requires some pretty specific detailed step-by-step stuff, then I tend to put it in a document. And I tend to do it in both a screencast and a document so that they can see it once and then refer back to the document, so it's a bulleted list. Now, for development projects, the only thing I tend to do in screencasts are more general overviews of this is, you know, this is the app, this is how it works, here's a look at it, here's the source tree, kind of just some overview stuff to get someone acquainted so they have an idea which way is up. I think the desire to not spec it out is something, Glenn, you might want to resist. In other words, I think that you are going to want to sit down and try to do a screencast walkthrough. And if you need a developer that is so good that they can, you know, kind of go through your code and figure out the API, then you will have to pay more money, you know. But if it's worth it to you, then do that. I mean, you may be able to find just kind of a lower end developer, a competent developer for 10 or 15 an hour, and you may need someone who's 30 or 40 an hour on Odesk. But if that keeps you from having to spec out everything in detail, and you can basically just send them to a page and kind of have them walk through and figure it out, that may be what you need to do. So it really is a balance of time versus money and the level of effort that you want to put out.
Yeah, I can't even begin to emphasize how helpful screencasts are. I mean, one of the things that I was doing this past week that I didn't really talk about earlier was that I had this idea for a SaaS application that I really don't have the time to work on it now, but I'm kind of looking at the market a little bit and saying, you know, is this viable? Is this something that I want to dedicate time to in the future? Or is it something that I could realistically put a spec together and then hand it off to a developer and say, here, I need you to build this. And while you're building it, I'm going to be working on Audit Shark and my forum software and building up some of the marketing stuff behind it. But I sent it off to Dan over at the Tropical MBA. And what he did is he actually sent me back a screencast. He didn't reply to my email. He sent me back a screencast and walked me through an example of one of the things that he does and said, here are exactly where my pain points are. And it was like a 10-minute video. It took him 10 minutes to obviously put it together and just send it back to me. And it was exactly what I needed.
Yeah, I would agree. I've really found value in screencasts. I actually now default to them unless it's a very specific detailed process or it's a true hardcore technical document that really needs to identify some specific points. I will always defer to recording a screencast. It actually winds up being way faster for you as the recorder because you can just sit down, you click through, you talk, and in 15 minutes, you can explain a heck of a lot of stuff, whereas this describing the same amount of information in a document could take, I mean, easily take an hour or two. And it's not as clear, you know, because you don't have the visual elements. You're trying to include screenshots and such like that. Just within the last maybe 6 weeks, I hired someone to create the billing engine, the recurring billing engine for Hittail. And it was all in my head of how to do it. And I knew that I could probably code it up in, I had between 8 and 12 hours in my head, which is right on the line, right? If I can code something in an hour or two, I have a really hard time going out and finding a new developer to do it because just the hiring process is more time than it's worth. But I already had someone who I know is pretty good. And at 8 to 12 hours, it's totally worth it to do that. So recorded a quick screencast explaining, yeah, that was just a 5-minute one, explaining the current flow and then what the new flow would be. And then I sat down to do the doc. And you know what? The doc took me 2 to 3 hours to write the spec. And so you might think, well, that wasn't a great return on my investment, right? But when I sent it to him, we started getting into it. And of course, it grows. And he points out some errors and he winds up writing some stuff that I hadn't thought of. And before long, it was up over, I mean, I think he wound up spending 20 hours on it. And I think I would have spent 20 hours on it as well. It's not like I'm, you know, some super fast developer compared to him. So in the end, I invested about maybe 4 hours tops. And I basically saved that 16 hours. And so that was 2 days that I had to do something else. So I know as a developer, it always feels like you can code it faster, but it's pretty ridiculous to think that if you spec out a massive thing, I mean, even if you spent 15, 20 hours speccing something out, if you spend that much time, then it's probably like a 100-hour project. And there's almost no doubt that you're going to get back many times your time investment returned.
Maybe one of the questions that he might have is, what do you do with these screencasts once you've got them built? I mean, do you protect them someplace? And where do you host them? Do you use like Wistia? I mean, I don't. I just...
Right. Yeah, no, that's actually a good question. So for VA screencasts, I upload them to screencast.com. Mm-hmm. And that's put on by the guys who do Camtasia. That is, I think it's $99 a year for quite a bit of bandwidth. There's a free plan up to a certain amount of bandwidth, and then it goes to $99 a year or something like that. And that way you can mark them as private, because otherwise you're right. You can, if you just upload them to a server, you can send someone a link. But then if someone else got a hold of that link or somehow found out about it, they can watch the screencast. You'd have to like password protect it specifically. So the nice part about screencast.com is you can either add a password to it specifically, or you can just make it so, you know, you need the link and it can't be found any other way. So, And the nice part there is it's not sucking up your server bandwidth if you're paying for that. And you can record pretty big ones. 1024 by 768 is pretty common for me. And screencast.com hosts it really well. And if you are recording in Camtasia, there's just a one click. It's like produce. It just renders it and uploads it right there, logs in for you, and it's all done. So you don't even need to FTP and do all that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, very cool. Thanks, Glenn, for writing in. I hope this was helpful for you and, of course, for you other listeners out there.
So before we go, the one last thing to mention is that we are finalizing the details for MicroConf. So this is kind of like your last chance to get on the MicroConf mailing list. Go to microconf.com, microconf.com, and you can sign up for the mailing list. And those tickets should be on sale, I would say, pretty soon. This episode will go out next week, and it should be shortly after that. So if you're interested in coming to MicroConf or just hearing a little bit more about it, getting some more details on it, definitely sign up for that mailing list. Otherwise, if you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690. Or you can email it in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Full transcript of this podcast will be available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.